The poor SOB, Dorothy Parker said in 1940 when F. Scott Fitzgerald died, quoting a character at Jay Gatsby's funeral. Gatsby's creator was just 44, but he died an old man. Alcohol, his wife Zelda's mental instability, and too many literary failures made Dorothy Parker's epitaph appropriate. F. Scott Fitzgerald died nearly destitute, thinking himself a failure. September 24th marks the centennial of F. Scott Fitzgerald's birth, and NPR's Susan Stamberg examines the life and work of this great American writer.
In 1913, a handsome and rather high-strung college freshman sat on the front steps of a stucco house in Princeton, New Jersey, gazing at a campus he'd loved from the first. A few years later, F. Scott Fitzgerald described what he saw in This Side of Paradise, the coming-of-age novel that made his reputation in 1920, when he was just 24, won him the hand of the girl he adored, and in many ways sealed his fate. Fitzgerald's hero, Amory Blaine, sits on his front steps on an autumn evening in his freshman year at Princeton.
The great tapestries of trees had darkened to ghosts back at the last edge of twilight. The early moon had drenched the arches with pale blue, and, weaving over the night, in and out of the gossamer rifts of moon, swept a song with more than a hint of sadness, infinitely transient, infinitely regretful. Now, far down the shadowy line of University Place, a white-clad phalanx broke the gloom, and marching figures, white-shirted, white-trousered, swung rhythmically up the street, with linked arms and heads thrown back. Going back, going back, going back to Nassau Hall. Amory closed his eyes as the ghostly procession drew near. The song soared so high that all dropped out except the tenors, who bore the melody triumphantly past the danger point and relinquished it to the fantastic chorus. Then Amory opened his eyes, half afraid that sight would spoil the rich illusion of harmony.
Leopold Grunspan. Regine Grunspan.
The Princeton campus is as lovely today as it was in 1913 when F. Scott Fitzgerald was a freshman. But the golden men of his youth make way now for women, Asians, blacks, Jews. Under a Gothic arch on Holocaust Memorial Day, students read names of those put to death by Nazis. Princeton's most famous undergraduate was Catholic, a Midwesterner, and gave little space in his early writings for men who weren't like him. Today at Princeton, they study This Side of Paradise, a book of privileged young men, lovely girls, romance, snobbishness, and, to today's readers, tinges of racism. Amory Blaine, on a train as World War I begins, encounters stinking aliens, Greeks, he guessed, or Russians. And, of course, at Princeton, they study Gatsby.
It captures the American dream, and then it shows the fallibility of that dream.
The dream of the mysterious self-made man, in love with beautiful, unattainable Daisy Buchanan. Jay Gatsby tries to reclaim their past romance, buy it back, possess it.
No one was really sure what it was he cared about. Was he caring about Daisy for real, or was he caring about himself?
Mary Rush Yelverton is a junior at Princeton, majoring in English.
It was hard to tell if he had real feelings for Daisy or if he just had feelings for this life that he wanted to have, this perfect life, and she was just another accoutrement towards that life. You know, she was the last and most essential ingredient.
Jay Gatsby, the bootlegger, with his custom-made shirts, his mansion in West Egg, his romantic readiness, and the parties that mesmerize narrator Nick Carraway.
There was music from my neighbor's house through the summer nights. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. On buffet tables garnished with glittering hors d'oeuvres, spiced baked hams crowded against salads of harlequin designs and turkeys bewitched to a dark gold. There was dancing on the canvas in the garden, old men pushing young girls backward in eternal, graceless circles. The lights grow brighter as the earth lurches away from the sun. And now the orchestra is playing yellow cocktail music, and the opera of voices pitches a key higher. Laughter is easier minute by minute, spilled with prodigality, tipped out at a cheerful word. The groups change more swiftly, swell with new arrivals, dissolve and form in the same breath. Already there are wanderers, confident girls who weave here and there among the stouter, more stable, become for a sharp, joyous moment the center of a group, and then, excited with triumph, glide on through the sea change of faces and voices and color under the constantly changing light.
You don't need that music. It's already there in the prose.
Novelist Richard Bausch. When Bausch was 26, he visited the Maryland cemetery where F. Scott Fitzgerald is buried and poured a $30 bottle of burgundy on his grave.
One of the things that he's doing is trying to be absolutely clear so that you get an image in your head that is transmitted from his imagination to yours, so that you're seeing exactly what his imagination is seeing.
There was music from my neighbor's house through the summer nights. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne.
There's one, Blue Gardens. The vividness of the prose has to do with these details that are said with such authority that you never question them. They roll over you like music.
And he's not saying girls in spangled dresses with fringes or any of those costumes of the time, but they're in my mind right now.
They're there.
From that word, moth.
Yeah.
On buffet tables garnished with glittering hors d'oeuvres, spiced baked hams crowded against salads of harlequin designs, and turkeys bewitched to a dark gold.
It all goes back to a letter to Scotty, his daughter, where he says, all fine prose is based on verbs carrying the sentences. They make sentences move. And then he uses a line of Keats's, the hare limped trembling through the frozen grass. And it's like a line from, you can see what Fitzgerald took from Keats, this amazing sensuality of vision.
Laughter is easier minute by minute, spilled with prodigality, tipped out at a cheerful word. The groups change more swiftly, swell with new arrivals, dissolve and form in the same breath. Already there are wanderers, confident girls who weave here and there among the stouter, more stable, become for a sharp, joyous moment the center of a group, and then, excited with triumph, glide on through the sea change of faces and voices and color under the constantly changing light.
You know what it does for me, listening to that? It makes me realize that's how groups move.
Yeah.
That's what parties look like.
Yep.
And the next one I go to, I'm going to see that
see
again.
See in terms of you, which is what every good writer wants. He wants you to see the world with his or her eyes the first time. The miracle of getting to look at the world through the eyes of somebody like Fitzgerald who was dead 5 years before I was born. That's an amazing thing.
The Great Gatsby is a nearly perfect book. Fitzgerald's themes mature here, heroic aspiration, the knowledge of money and what it costs. The rich are careless in Gatsby. They create disasters and let others clean them up. Illusions, perpetuated, then lost. Elaine Showalter teaches a seminar on Fitzgerald at Princeton.
I think The Great Gatsby is a beautiful and wonderful novel, and it's entered very deep into the American psyche. But I think you could say as well that Fitzgerald's image of heroic self-invention leaves out a lot about women, class, and race. Working class people are on the margins or on the outskirts. They're not entirely human. Later, he began to change that view. But The Great Gatsby is really a myth, and it is a myth of America.
F. Scott Fitzgerald lived the myth for a handful of years in the early 1920s. A grocer's grandson, raised on the edge of St. Paul's high society, he craved fame and fortune and got it early. At first, Fitzgerald wore success like a boutonniere. He was blonde, blue-eyed, heartthrob handsome, and his wife was a prize, vivacious, a charmer. There were mansions in America, villas in France, an adorable daughter, pranks and parties, too much champagne, but always the sense that it might not last. I remember riding in a taxi one afternoon, Fitzgerald wrote, between very tall buildings under a mauve and rosy sky. I began to bawl because I had everything I wanted and knew I would never be so happy again. He was young to be so wise. The instrument that burst their bubble was always at hand in a liquor bottle. Scott and Zelda were to drinking what Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers were to dancing, essayist Joseph Epstein writes. By 1929, the year the stock market crashed, Fitzgerald's drinking had gotten out of control, and Zelda, the flirtatious Southern belle he so adored, was in and out of mental hospitals. His next novel, Tender is the Night, wasn't finished until 1934. The story of wealthy expatriates on the Riviera and a man who is used up, consumed by his needy wife. The book was a flop. In the midst of the Depression, critics said Fitzgerald was hiding from a hurricane under a beach umbrella. In 1935, Fitzgerald published Lamp in the Window, a poem addressed to Zelda.
Do you remember, before keys turned in the locks, when life was a close-up and not an occasional letter, that I hated to swim naked from the rocks while you liked absolutely nothing better? Do you remember many hotel bureaus that had only three drawers? But the only bother was that each of us got holy, then got mad, trying to give the third one to the other. East, west, the little car turned, often wrong, up an erroneous Alp, an unmapped Savoy River. We blamed each other. Wild were our words and strong, and in an hour laughed and called it liver. And though the end was desolate and unkind, to turn the calendar at June and find December on the next leaf, still, stupid got with grief, I find these are the only quarrels that I can remember.
Now, F. Scott Fitzgerald himself.
My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as if of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains.
This is the only known recording of his voice. He made it in Hollywood, where he moved in 1937. He's trying to recite from memory his beloved Keats, Ode to a Nightingale, a poem about immortality.
Here where men sit and hear each other groan, where palsy shakes a few last sad gray hairs, where youth grows dumb and fever thin and dies, new love cannot live beyond tomorrow, where beauty cannot live. Hello, that's the end. Never mind, cut it off now.
In Hollywood, Fitzgerald stops drinking, not right away and never totally, and begins a novel that is full of his finest gifts. It's 1937. Zelda is in a sanitarium in North Carolina. Their daughter Scotty is at Vassar. Fitzgerald has gone west to write for the movies.
I was a very young screenwriter.
Bud Schulberg was 25 years old. Later, he wrote the screenplay for On the Waterfront and the novel What Makes Sammy Run, about Hollywood venality.
I'd been working on the script, and the producer thought it could stand some improvement. He told me he was putting another writer on it with me. And when I asked who, he said, F. Scott Fitzgerald. I really thought he was putting me on. In fact, my first flash response was that I thought Scott Fitzgerald was dead. The answer was, no, he's not dead. In fact, he's in the next office reading your treatment.
Fitzgerald worked on several films, including Gone with the Wind, but got screen credit for just one, Three Comrades. Joseph Mankiewicz was the producer. Mankiewicz completely revised Fitzgerald's screenplay. In 1980, he told NPR why.
Scott just simply couldn't write. He couldn't write because dialogue written for actors is projected from a stage or the screen, and the audience ingests it not through the eyes, but through the ears.
No, I don't agree with Joe about that. I think that Joe was speaking to some extent out of his conflict with Scott. Scott, first of all, in his short stories and his novels writes excellent dialogue, and I think in his screenplays also.
Cut it out, would you?
You see that bastard touch my daughter?
Who is he?
Some goddamn writer.
You know, I went down the writer's building this morning. I stood there and watched them for 15 minutes. There were two of them there, didn't write a line.
MGM paid Fitzgerald $1,000 a week for a while. Then they dropped his option. He freelanced, tinkering with the scripts of others, and kept producing short stories to earn money. In 1939, his health failing, but winning mostly a battle to stay sober, he began work on a novel about Hollywood.
He wrote with a knife sharpened pencil, not one with a blunt edge point. And he wrote on legal size paper, long sheets of paper. And he had a bed desk and wrote mostly in bed. There wasn't really a routine because it depended on how he felt and when he had the energy to write. Mostly he would write in the mornings. Sometime he would write at night when he couldn't sleep, and it would be ready for me to type in the morning.
Francis Kroll Ring earned $35 a week, a good salary then, typing up those pages. The new book was The Last Tycoon. Monroe Starr, S-T-A-H-R, is the hero. A Jay Gatsby with genius, says leading Fitzgerald scholar Matthew Brookley. Starr is a Hollywood mogul, an artist businessman who tries to recapture a lost love. We know this not from finished text, Fitzgerald's heart gave out before he could complete the novel, but from the meticulous notes, drafts, outlines he set down with those pencils Francis sharpened for him. What did he think he was doing? Did he think he was creating a great novel?
Yes. He had real faith in his ability to turn out a great novel. He wanted to present the inner workings of a studio, not just the glamour, but the attitude, the economy, the power structure. This was to be a really serious study of Hollywood.
All the themes Fitzgerald explored in This Side of Paradise, Gatsby, even Tender is the Night, are here, but they are expanded, deepened. Love lost, briefly recaptured, then lost again by choice. Illusions created deliberately this time, for profit, by a Hollywood dreammaker, a successful hero, a professional who rules his world. Although in the world of F. Scott Fitzgerald, Monroe Starr was an outsider.
His hero is Jewish.
Yes.
But there is some of the writing about that is a little uncomfortable.
Like what?
Starr at one point says, I'd like to meet this big Jew that tried to blow over the Ford factory. He's talking to somebody. Or he describes Starr, he says he has had an intense respect for learning a racial memory of the old shuls.
There have been accusations of anti-Semitism, not in this book, but I think in Gatsby, where he made the gangster a Jew. But the gangster that he based it on was a Jew. And I think excessive sensitivity to this is really out of place, I think. Mm. I happen to be Jewish, and I didn't find any trace of antagonism or racism. I really didn't.
According to the outline, Fitzgerald's Jewish hero dies in a plane crash after arranging the murder of a treacherous partner. Pretty melodramatic. But Bud Schulberg says Fitzgerald just might have pulled it off.
When you look at The Great Gatsby, just the bare bones of the plot of the ending is quite melodramatic. It was only the way Scott handled it that took the onus, in a sense, off that feeling that he was writing melodrama.
Even unfinished, unrevised, and overdramatic, Fitzgerald's last work is considered the best novel ever written about movie making, an absorbing, thrilling book. In 1977, Harold Pinter wrote a screenplay of The Last Tycoon. This scene is taken almost word for word from Fitzgerald's manuscript. Robert De Niro, as Starr, encourages a writer who's having trouble with a script.
Do you ever go to the movies?
Rarely.
Because people are always dueling and falling down wells.
And talking a load of rubbish.
Listen, has your office got a stove in it that lights with a match?
I think so.
Suppose you're in your office. You've been fighting duels all day. You're exhausted. A girl comes in. Takes off her gloves. She opens a purse. She dumps it out on the table. You watch her. She has two dimes, a matchbox, and a nickel. She she leaves the nickel on the table. She puts the two dimes back into her purse. She takes the gloves. They're black. Puts them into the stove. Lights a match. Suddenly, the telephone rings. She picks it up. She listens. She says, I've never owned a pair of black gloves in my life. Hangs up, feels by the stove, lights another match. Suddenly, you notice. There's another man in the room.
What happens?
I don't know. I was just making pictures.
What was the nickel for?
Jane, what was the nickel for?
The nickel was for the movies.
Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald is buried in his family's plot up off an indifferent highway in Rockville, Maryland. On the 4th of July each year, neighbors sit in St. Mary's Church graveyard to watch local fireworks. The comets and chrysanthemums and shooting stars flare out against the dark summer sky, then spill in a glittering descent. In his centennial year, the brilliance seems to mirror the brief life of this American writer and the heroes he created. Like Starr, like Gatsby, like Fitzgerald too, the fireworks blaze and then come undone. But oh, the dazzle. I'm Susan Stamp.
Our story on the centennial of F. Scott Fitzgerald was produced by Nina Ellis, with research help from Lauren Sandler.